This whole notion of preserving natural areas for the next generation, a wonderful idea, but getting there often requires a lot of hard work and a lot of community cooperation. Larry Mueller here, our guest today, has been on the front lines of conservation efforts on the eastern shores of Lake Michigan. She's Heather Shoemaker. Heather's worked in land conservation for about two decades and was coastal program director for Protecting Arcadia Dunes. She has a Master of Science degree in land resources right from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, a national speaker. And we've had her on the show before, but talking about totally different topics. She has a couple of other books, Okay, It's Okay Not to Share, and It's Okay to Go Up the Slide. Her new book is called Saving Arcadia, A Story of Conservation and Community in the Great Lakes. You may be involved in a project to preserve land in one way or another. You may and have some questions or maybe experiences to share. I hope you'll join in as we talk with Heather. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org or post on the email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. We'd certainly love to hear from you. And Heather Shoemaker, welcome back.
Thanks so much. Good to be here.
Yeah, well, good to have you back. You know, this is quite a different topic. The last couple of times we've talked about raising children, and I frankly didn't even know that you had 20 years in land conservation.
I know. I like to surprise you. But this is why I first moved to Wisconsin. I live in Michigan now, but I moved to Wisconsin to go to the University of Wisconsin-Madison's graduate school program in environmental studies. So this is sort of getting back to my roots.
Yeah, it's wonderful. The book itself is great. I love the narrative style in this book. First, maybe give our listeners a thumbnail sketch of what you've got here.
Well, I think of it as a David and Goliath story, one that's sort of a land conservation adventure story. And I think when people think about land conservation, they don't really think about adventuring, you know, Indiana Jones-type adventures. But really, the business of preserving the earth and saving land and preserving coastal areas has a lot of adventures, and I think we don't always know what goes on. Sometimes we hear the bad news and we don't hear about all the victories and the excitement. So this is my way of sharing what it's like behind the scenes and sharing some of that drama so we can all appreciate the land we have, the land and waters, and the people who work so hard for it.
Yeah. And the area that you were involved with, Arcadia, actually my next door neighbors spend a week every summer over there climbing around on Old Baldy and some of the other places. So they were really excited when I said I was going to have you on, and they want to read your book for sure. But describe the area that you're talking about here.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of Wisconsin people come over to this side of Lake Michigan because of the sand. You know, we have this is the sandy side. There's a lot of huge mountains of sand, perched dunes, and all kinds of coastal dunes. And so the area I'm talking about, it's this magnificent, more than 300-foot towering sand dune, and it's nearly deserted. I mean, there's visitors, but it's like a beach that's all yours. It's sugar sand beach, blue water of Lake Michigan. And the area I'm talking about is a 6,000-acre nature preserve full of forest, and it's got endangered species. It's got, just knock-your-socks-off views that's a lot of what draws people there, is just how gorgeous it is.
Yeah, it really is beautiful. Well, tell us what happened to this land in the early 70s.
Yes, well, what happened is a stranger came to town, and they say there's only two stories in all literature. Either a stranger comes to town or you go on a journey. And I think that's a John Gardner quote. Anyway, in this case, a stranger literally came to town. He came to this sleepy corner of Benzie County, Michigan, and started knocking on the doors of farmhouses and bought up eventually. No one knew who he was. They knew he had some big money behind him, but they didn't know who he was representing at first. And he started buying up farm properties and forested properties until he'd assembled 6,000 acres in one huge ownership block. And it turned out, the mystery was solved, it turned out it was a public utility called Consumers Power at the time, and today it's part of CMS Energy. So they bought that up, and they had plans to flood the area. The reason this towering dune is so impressive, but it's also got impressive height, and their plan was to build an enormous reservoir and pump up water to the top and then let the water dash down when they needed to generate peak power.
And a lot of people wanted to hang on to the land, but they, in the end, sold anyway. Or were able to arrange some sort of rental deal with the owners.
Yeah, that's interesting, because a lot of the farmers, after they sold their land, and most of them sold it eventually because they felt threatened by eminent domain, that as a utility can come in and condemn land just like a branch of the government. So they sold the land, but then the public utility didn't take any action after getting ownership, and so the land sort of sat there, and they leased back much of the land to the original farm families, and so they had a lot of uncertainty they had to live with year by year or 5-year increments depending on the lease. So they couldn't really, they were in the business of orchard family farming. On this side of the lake, there's a lot of fruit sites, apples and cherries and even grapes and things. So that's long-term farming instead of a yearly cash crop of corn or something. So they weren't able to make long-term plans, and the land sort of started to disintegrate. All the trees got, the orchard trees fell into disrepair, so to speak.
Yeah, and things were kind of going south. Well, how did you land over there?
Well, I landed in this part of Michigan because it started when I was in Madison, and I was just graduating from my program at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and I had holes in my shoes, and I was broke, and I needed a job. So I got a job as a land protection specialist with a land trust called the Grand Traverse Regional Land Conservancy. And they handed me a slice of Michigan and said, this is your habitat to protect, help protect family farms and orchards and help protect natural habitat and lakes and streams and coastline.
Yeah.
And I was scanning maps to see, this is all willing landowners. It's a nonprofit, so we would only talk to people who were interested and only work with willing landowners. So I had to get to know who owned the land, and I was scanning a plat map of all the land ownership and stumbled on this huge ownership area that was all one name. And I thought, goodness, who is this CMS Energy, and why do they own thousands of acres all in one big block?
It was interesting. And trust, you might just, describe what is a land trust?
Yeah, a land trust, and I actually heard that part of this program is sponsored by the Nature Conservancy. They are an international example of a land trust. But there's lots of local land trusts, and it's a nonprofit that works with various goals to preserve open space for recreation, for natural habitat, for farmland preservation. It depends on the goal of the land trust. But they sometimes buy land and set it aside as a nature preserve. Sometimes they separate off the development rights so you can't maybe build on that area, so it's preserved into the future. So it's open land either for trail access or for farming or for natural land. And then the land trust has a responsibility to hold those development rights and keep them safe and make sure that that land is preserved into the future.
Yeah. And so a lot of your job, or part of your job, at least in the beginning, right through, was to go out and talk with a lot of people. And I remember somewhere in your book you said, gee, I wish I'd had more psychology courses and a fewer courses on forestry or something like that.
Yeah, well, I was, I was well prepared by my classes in Madison, but they were heavy on the ecology and the conservation biology and all the conservation sciences, and not so much on how to get people to do what you hope they will do. And I was, I was in my young 20s, and I was a little nervous, too, because I'd written a lot of academic papers about how to talk to landowners and stakeholders, but I'd never done it before. So here I was thrown into Michigan and seeing if I could talk to some folks and really make a difference on the landscape. And so I got used to talking to landowners, but then we had to talk to a corporation, a major corporation, and that was a different kettle of fish altogether.
it was indeed. Well, I tell you what, the whole idea, the group that you were with, the organization you were with, was led by Glenn, I think his name, a very tireless, hardworking individual.
Yes.
Man.
Yes. Well, I think a lot of nonprofits are led by passion, especially in the beginning. And Glenn Chown was the founder of this Grand Traverse Conservancy and still there today. And he brought tireless energy to the nonprofit. And that driving energy really drove so much of the project. But, of course, he needed someone to be the detail person and keep things organized. So I kind of came in with that aspect.
Well,
we were dreaming together. When I looked at that map and I saw this huge expanse of land, I caught the glint in his eye. We were both two passionate dreamers who thought, who else do we need to bring in to make something like this happen? How can we pull this off? It's audacious. How do we do it?
6 or 7,000 acres you set your eyes on.
Yeah, and we didn't have the money for it.
Well, you started out, you were in a kind of a small little building, as I recall, not a lot of fancy equipment or anything, just a lot of zeal.
A lot of zeal. I mean, we stored letters in the bathtub until we dragged them to the post office. We were living in an old creaky house, and we didn't have enough computers or phone lines or anything. But we were determined, and I think determination can really be the main ingredient you need to get the ball rolling, to be bold and have a dream and then pursue it. So since we didn't have everything we needed, we had to bring in a lot of people, and this story gets into some of the people that we brought in. I mean, it ranges from innkeepers, such as your friends who vacation over on mm-hmm. the Arcadia area, and bakers and local folks like that, and neighborhood farmers, all the way up to the governor of the state.
Yeah.
So we brought in everybody we thought could possibly help, and then some.
We're going to continue the story of Heather Shoemaker and all of the people that worked on Saving Arcadia. We'll take a quick look at the news, and then we'll be back. You stay with us. Maybe there's a special place in nature that you like to visit, and maybe you'd like it to be preserved for future generations. Larry Mueller here. Our guest today can tell you how it can be accomplished because she and a bunch of other people were able to do it in Michigan. Heather Shoemaker is on the phone with us. She's the author of the new book called Saving Arcadia, A Story of Conservation and Community in the Great Lakes. She's worked in land conservation for a couple of decades, was coastal program director for Protecting Arcadia Dunes. And it's really great to have her with us. She got her master's degree in land resources from the UW-Madison. I hope you'll join in with your own experiences, maybe connected to land preservation. Maybe you're working on something right now and want some advice, or maybe just interested in her story. I hope you'll give a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Can email us at ideas@wpr.org or go ahead and post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. We'd certainly love to hear from you. Tell us a little bit about Watervale and how it helped get the community into action.
Well, Watervale is a Victorian era logging camp that got turned into a summer resort. but not the kind of resort you might think of with lots of mown lawns and so on. It's got Victorian buildings, and it's just nestled next to forest and lake. And those people there have run it as a family for getting on 100 years. And all the families that come and vacation there, year after year, and they have a special week when they all go, their hearts get buried more and more deeply into the sand dunes and the forest and the natural world. And so when this the sand dune, locally called Old Baldy, was threatened, we're not just talking about a week of emotion. We're talking about generations of emotion, you know, going back through the grandparents had come and visited here. And so the innkeepers at Watervale were able to tap into deep love and through lots of families that lived all over the Midwest, Chicago and St. Louis and Cleveland and all over Milwaukee, who came here and vacationed here, because northern Michigan is an area where people come to escape the summer heat and glory in the beauty of the sand dunes. And so Watervale became one of the key places that helped rally to donate money. The dishwashers in the back kitchen were donating money, but so were families that had family foundations and could give many more thousands.
Yeah, and we're talking here about a lot of money.
Yes, a lot of money. And at first, we didn't even know how much, because we were trying to get the attention of a major corporation, CMS Energy, that owned the land. And even to find out, would they work with us on getting an appraisal to find out how much this 6,000-acre huge expanse of land was valued at. So even some of those steps were a challenge. But we ended up having to raise about $30 million for this sand dune and one up just a little further up the coast. So it was a lot of money, but it wasn't just for buying the land. The whole price tag had to think about, well, let's assume that we do buy the land. Then what? How much money is it going to cost to take good care of it and to hire people to help and to get volunteers to help reforest the land and pull up invasive species and pull out old cars that were in dumps? And how much is it going to cost in total, not just the price tag to buy it?
Yeah. And that company was earlier known as Enron, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, the Enron connection, and not directly. We had a stroke of luck. You know, sometimes when you work really hard at a project, it's your hard work that does it all. But once in a while, you also need a little help from the fates of luck. And what happened was the utility was pretty much turning us down and deciding that a little nonprofit and their summer fundraising plan really wasn't strong enough to take to the bank. And so they started going with a more predictable buyer, which would be a developer. They understood how developers worked. They worked with them a lot, but they didn't understand land trusts. So they were turning to a developer to turn this into a large upscale development with golf courses and ruin the natural habitat, and turned us down. And we had to pretty much say, this project is done, when all of a sudden our luck changed. And the stories that were flying, it was Enron was doing round-trip trading. Well, it turned out that CMS Energy had also engaged in that kind of cooking-the-books behavior. And it resulted in a big shakeup in the leadership of that corporation. So then we got to work with different people, and then the whole deal started unfolding the way we were hoping it would.
Yeah. And you had to bring in some people with a woman, for example, and I'm blanking on her name right now, a more of a marketing type person who really helped along the way.
Yeah, we hired somebody who understood financial campaigns, who'd helped big universities do capital campaigns, because normally a little tiny nonprofit doesn't try to raise $30 million, and we actually had to raise $5 million in just one summer, because summer is the time when everybody vacations up north, and we need to capture them when they were here. So we hired somebody who understood campaigns, and she was a great help. But we also partnered with so many groups, including the Nature Conservancy of Michigan, and they were able to open doors that we couldn't touch, board members that they had, or they could talk to leaders of various foundations and corporations and help us get the leadership we needed to pull the project off.
Yeah. But it was, I love the way you write you've written this book, because there's a lot of tension, and every other chapter you think, well, is this going to fall through, or is this all going to come together?
And yeah. There were many cliffhangers, and at the time, of course, it was a wrenching part of life to live through, because there was so much at stake. But we didn't know if it would work out. In fact, there were many times we thought it wouldn't. But perseverance did wonders. We kept at it for a number of years. And this is a good news environmental story. There's not that many of those out there.
Yeah.
But this is one where it's a dash of hope. It gives inspiration, because it has a happy ending. And I just got a note from a young reader who is an AmeriCorps volunteer, and his job is, you know, for the 10 months to be out in the land doing some restoration. And he wrote and said, this book has reinvigorated, it's given me a new spark in my conservation career, and it helps us. I'm planning to go to graduate school in ecology, and this is making me feel like I can do it again, because there's so much doom and gloom, and we all need that inspiration.
You know, you did a great job, I think, describing what happens when forests are fragmented. And you're talking about here 6,000 acres or and change, a lot of it forest land. And what happens, though, when the forest land is fragmented?
Well, a lot of this property is forested, as you said. Yeah. Only a small part is farmland. And so the forest, when it's fragmented, and the fragmented could mean that somebody puts in a logging road. I mean, it might not be cutting a huge area down, just doing something simple like putting in a small dirt road. And that breaks up the canopy, so it removes some larger trees in that area. But it also introduces a pathway for a lot of things to come in, whether it's species that aren't meant to live there that can then come along the path in the tires of a car and take over. Displace the native plant habitat. It can also bring in predators for some of the birds. We were particularly concerned with some of the songbirds that nested on the ground. And when a road or some sort of fragmentation opens up the forest, a lot more of these predators come in. So even though there may be almost the same number of acres of forest, when you start punching holes in the forest with little clearings or roads or any kind of intrusion into the forest, it has a dramatic impact on so many levels: the chemistry of the forest, the different species, the composition of the tree species, and the wildlife in the forest.
And you mentioned the farmland, and I think the area included farmland, and this type of land usually isn't the type that would go into a land conservancy, but it does fit in with the whole idea of keeping things natural, I think.
Yeah, we had two interesting parts of the more cultivated and more impacted land. One is a lot of it was orchard land, and in this side of the Great Lake in Michigan, there's some real concern in preserving good fruit sites. So there's some parts of the land that have a high enough elevation and aren't hurt by frost, and they're close enough to the Great Lakes that the climate is buffered, that they produce some wonderful orchards for apples and cherries. And it's been a state priority to help preserve some of these fruit lands and not have them turn into housing developments or something else. So this was actually part of our mission. And I learned from some ecologists who came out and walked on the land with me, because we were saving a landscape, not just a little park to put a fence around and say, this is a nature preserve, but we were trying to preserve an entire landscape. And that included the economic livelihood of a lot of the local people in that area and their orchards. So we were trying to preserve those orchards as part of the fabric of the natural habitat. And what I found out from some of these ecologists is that there are different levels of farming that can be really compatible with natural land preservation. And one of the best ones is tree farming, Christmas tree farming or any other kind of tree farming, because the land isn't plowed up and churned up all the time. It's a long-term planting. And so a lot of wildlife can thrive and make it can be part of the fabric of the whole thing.
Yeah. Jamie in Campbellsport has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Jamie. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Hi. I love the show.
Thank you.
I am just very inspired by your story, and I'm definitely going to read your book. I work for a nonprofit on the Cedarburg Bog in Wisconsin. It's a major wetland watershed, and I do invasive species control there. I work on glossy buckthorn. We've cleared about 300 acres of the bog, and I've been a big part of that, and it's a lot of work. But I was going to say, I'm just inspired by the whole story because of the, we just got approved for a new grant called the Bog Guardian Program, and I'm definitely going to be applying for that job, and I'm just, and it's a lot of outreach, talking to neighbors. It's a lot of farmland around the Cedarburg Bog, and yeah, I just wanted to say that, so.
Well, yeah, you definitely need to pick up a copy of the book, Jamie.
Yeah, I will.
Have you heard similar stories from other people, Heather?
Well, mostly that everybody is appreciative of that dash of hope, because even though this story that I'm telling is the story of preserving one landscape, you know, one sand dune called Arcadia Dunes, the same model of inclusiveness and community building in order to achieve something sort of grand, it can be applied anywhere. And if you don't have, maybe you have the ingredients of passion or hard work or whatever it is, but you need other ingredients to be successful, just find them. And what we found is that if we provided the dream and the passion and a bit of a logical plan to go with it, people with other skills and other money and other resources would rally around that. People sometimes need that leader with the bold dream in order to put their energy towards something good. So sometimes just getting started can draw more people in, because you need more than just one hard worker.
That's for sure. Thanks again, Jamie. Gary in Boscobel, your turn. Hi, Gary.
Thanks, Larry. As the founder of the Prairie Enthusiast, I can relate to many of the things, almost all the things you're saying about the struggles and raising money and getting citizens on board and inspiring people and working with landowners. And one of our biggest concerns is at 3,000 acres of ownership of tall grass prairie and another 1,000 with conservation easements on, it's the long-term management and restoration work is really the daunting task. It turns out that the money that needed to be raised to buy these places is probably the smallest expense of the whole thing. And I've found out working with crews that being a leader and being inspirational and making progress and seeing end results really is the key to keeping volunteers on board and keeping enthusiasm high and getting people to want to finish a project and move on to the next one with the excitement that they experienced from the first one. And it's very uplifting, and it really broadens your horizons when you have to work with landowners and corporations and individual personalities to achieve these goals. But the end result is really, really well worth it.
Mm. Thanks so much for calling, Gary. Appreciate it. And Heather, a comment from you. You actually have some really nice, your latter chapters are, well, now we've got this, we've spent this $30 million, we got this 6,000 acres. How the heck are we going to ever take care of it?
Right, and I think that's what Gary was saying. You know, buying the land, it's a huge part, but it's a small part, both money-wise and time-wise, in the big scheme of things. So now that you have the land, you have to take care of it in perpetuity. That's a long time. And to do that, you need to keep that energy he was talking about and keep bringing in new people, because that's what ultimately saves land is each generation falling in love with it and getting their hands dirty and being out in the landscape helping and volunteering. I think that's often missed by many of us in land conservation, is how important it is to sustain that energy through time, because you can only say it's preserved on paper unless you have that active involvement. And one thing that I love about this Saving Arcadia story is just one of our main funders, the C.S. Mott Foundation, the reason they became a major funder for the project is because their president took a walk on the beach and looked up at this amazing sand dune and had a flashback to his childhood where he'd grown up on Cape Cod and he loved dunes out there. And the dunes that he'd grown up with as a boy were obliterated by development when he went back to visit them years later. And so he fell in love with the dunes as a child. And when he saw this one that was pristine and hadn't been developed, he just said, my gosh, we've got to save something. So it's that tapping into those deep memories and experiences of being outdoors in the wild in childhood. And that's something that we can draw on in everybody's heart today. But we also need to make sure that, and my other hat is children, so get the children outside and out in wild places so that in the future they will continue to be inspired to help save land as adults.
And one of the things you talk about in there, you mentioned fragmentation earlier. At the same time, when you have a conservancy like this, people have to be able to use it. And you talk about in there, as an example, in trails that you were able to develop in the forest, that where you worked with an environmental group that had lots of good experience putting them together.
Right. Designing actually sustainable trails that wouldn't hurt the landscape but would allow some access. Because there's always a balance, and there's many different complexities to saving land, but one of them is how do you allow people in to enjoy it without having them love it to death? And there's so many balances and that need to be taken into account with that, but including accessibility for people who have disabilities, and where do you do that, and where can you do it in a place that's meaningful to people but doesn't impact the landscape too much. So lots and lots of balances, compromise, and ultimately keeping the mission of preserving the land at forefront.
Yeah. And there are some, I don't know, tricks is not the right word, but I remember somebody went out to Maine, I believe, to look at what they were doing out there, and they had prepared some like $50,000 worth of brochures that were essentially useless.
Yes. We took field trips because, you know, when you're under the gun to raise a lot of money fast and get a big project going, you don't want to waste time reinventing things. So we took field trips to other places that had done similar projects and learned from them. And these brochures that were stacking up in Maine were, they'd taken gorgeous photographs to try to get people to donate money to their cause, but they hadn't put any people in the pictures, in these pictures of wild nature. And learning that you have to, they photoshopped the people in eventually, so they weren't totally lost. But the idea of connecting, remembering the heart and people, and making sure that people are connected both in visual images that we see to inspire us, but also getting people out in the land and introducing them, getting them outside. We took a lot of guided hikes to help people meet the dunes because it's very hard to let something be destroyed once you've been introduced.
Yeah, that's the thing. Or took them out on boats and had them look from the water.
Yes.
At those dunes. Well, what if you were going to give some advice here in about a minute to a conservancy group, what's the main advice that you have for conservancy groups or members who may be listening right now?
Well, I think keeping up the hope, and if you have a big dream, don't be nervous about it. Just bring in the people that you need. I think partnerships are key, and tapping into people's love of land, which is deep, deep in their hearts. No matter, you know, today is a time of political dividedness in our country, but I think land can connect us because everybody has that soft spot in their hearts for some special place, whether it was a fishing hole or even a tree in their grandmother's backyard. You know, it doesn't have to be completely wild wilderness. But some special spot in nature that you can tap into and say, remember that, that's worth saving.
Well, you have written a fascinating book. I have to tell you, after I interviewed you about It's Okay to Go Up the Slide, I bought 6 copies of that book, and I handed them over to some of the teachers in my daughter's school just for some inspiration, and I'll probably be doing the same thing for this book. Heather, it was a lot of fun talking with you. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Heather Shoemaker, our guest, author of Saving Arcadia, A Story of Conservation and Community in the Great Lakes. Really fascinating read. And, boy, thank you so much for listening. Tomorrow at 11:45, we talk with an IRS criminal investigation special agent about private debt collectors working with the IRS, tax frauds and scams. Stay with us.